Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Traveling the Way of the Bodhisattva by Lama Tom Broadwater. Over the course of the next few months, Lama Tom will lead us through the path of the Bodhisattva, the spiritual warrior, the hero of Mahayana Buddhism. This first talk will be about the reasons why we take on the identity of a bodhisattva. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning and welcome. Is this the first time for anybody to be here? Everyone? Oh, welcome.
In this building.
Yeah, okay. Great. Terrific. So welcome to everyone this morning. It's a beautiful morning. I started out from Zanesville, and it's cloudy and cold. It's still cold, but it's nice and beautiful out today. Parking lots filled, lots of people here. All good things. So the question that's before us, as soon as we come into practice or to listen to Dharma is, why am I here? What's the point of my being here? We have all kinds of reasons for our coming here this morning. Everybody has slightly different. But the best motivation, the motivation that we want to try to cultivate is we're here for all the people that we love, all the people that we know, and even the people we don't know, for all people, because why? All beings suffer, right? Do you know anyone that doesn't? And so we're motivated by the idea that maybe somehow or another, through my growing up, my maturing, we call it Buddhahood, by my attaining Buddhahood, that I'm going to be able to help those suffering beings as well as myself. So we're here for that. And we're going to do the refuge prayer. There's two different sheets that passed out, but this says refuge prayer. And what this is something we say every time we do practice. And it's basically we're looking ahead to the point where we are actually awakened. And we recollect all beings and their suffering and thinking that if I can grow up, if I can mature, if I can become a Buddha, I'm going to be able to help them. In the meantime, I'm going to maintain this aspiration that if I could, I would. So let's read this together three times, and we'll read it in English. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. by the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Next week, on Saturday, Lama Kathy is offering what is called the Bodhisattva Vow. And if you have taken refuge, which is the one requirement, if you've taken refuge, you're more than welcome. And in fact, I would invite you to come next Saturday from 10 to 12:30 and receive that vow, the Bodhisattva Vow. Today, what I'm going to talk about is about being a bodhisattva and what we call bodhicitta. This talk is going to be about bodhicitta. And we'll define what bodhicitta means in this talk itself. The teaching that I'm going to give today actually came from a fellow by the name of Ken Holmes. He's a great Tibetan teacher. I think he now resides in France. The teaching that I basically am modeling my teaching from, he gave about a year ago. His teaching took about an hour and a half, so I've pared this talk down a bit. According to, you know, those where you plug in how many words and then it says how long it's going to take. Well, I plugged this talk in terms of words of 3,800 words in my talk today. It should take me 15 minutes because I'm a slow talker. It might take me a little bit longer. But in any case, this talk is from Ken Holmes, and I pared it down a bit. I've asked Ken Holmes in the past if he minded my taking his words, and he said, no, of course, use them if you want. So you could sort of say he's the ventriloquist and I'm the dummy giving the talk today. Any errors in this talk are mine, and any good things that you get out of the talk will be the result of Ken Holmes. So, all the teachings surrounding bodhisattva and the bodhisattva vow are beautiful, so beautiful. And there are many, many talks and many, many teachings related to the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva is sort of like the hero of the Mahayana vehicle. The person who says, however long it's going to take, I'm going to strive to become a Buddha. And I'm going to do that not just for myself, but for all suffering beings. So it's a very beautiful concept, this concept of the bodhisattva, the hero, the warrior, that despite all the problems he or she may have, they're going to try to reach Buddhahood. Again, they're very warm-hearted teachings. They're not about some Dharma out there. They're not about some Buddha in some other realm. They're teachings about you and me, our hearts, and our minds. So let's start out with the word bodhicitta and the people who become bodhisattvas. Bodhicitta in Sanskrit, that's what it is in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, it's janchup. I'm not a great Tibetan scholar. I can barely read it, but janchup is the word in Tibetan for bodhisattva. Bodhicitta. The word for bodhisattva in Tibetan is janchup sempa. So bodhisattva is also a Sanskrit word. So let's break this word up a bit. What does bodh, as in bodhicitta, what does bodh, where does that come from? Well, in Sanskrit, it's the same root as Buddha. And the Tibetans translate Buddha as Sanjay or Sangay. And Sanjay contains two words, Sang, which means awakened, and Gay, which means fully bloomed. So what does waking up mean in the word Sang? What does that mean to wake up? When we're asleep, we're unconscious, right? We're sort of involved in a dream state. Waking up, in this case, is like a quantum leap from sleep. So the Buddha was the one who woke up from illusions, all the illusions that make up existence. Here's another way to look at it. The Buddha woke up from the hypnotic power of the six consciousnesses, the consciousness, eye consciousness, hearing, all those consciousnesses. He woke up and he transformed them all into primordial wisdom. The play of consciousness, like the eye consciousness or the ear consciousness, etc., is like the state of being asleep. The Buddha woke up and saw how everybody else was asleep and in dreams. As an adolescent, I was in a Catholic seminary. There were about 80 of us, and we all slept in a dormitory together. And every once in a while, I'd wake up from my sleep. I'd look around. I'd see everybody else sleeping, unconscious in their dreams or in their nightmares, whatever they were. That's sort of like what it is with the Buddha. He woke up. He looked around, and he saw everybody sleeping in their dreams, in their nightmares. And he vowed to wake everybody up. The second part of the Tibetan word Sanjay, and in the Sanskrit it's bodh, is gay or j. Depends upon whether you want a hard g or soft g there. And the second meaning is to become fully blossomed. I was in Kentucky this weekend and I saw daffodils. They're starting to bloom. They're starting to bloom around here, actually, some places. But it's the idea of becoming fully open, fully bloomed. And we're going to be seeing that around here a lot in the next couple of weeks, flowers blooming. So the second meaning of the word bodh or sanjay in Tibetan is that all the qualities of the mind fully bloom, fully blossom. And in that state, the mind could not be more peaceful, more profoundly wise, love couldn't be deeper, and the power to help other beings could not be more fruitful. Everything's reached its fullness. That's what a Buddha is. Sang, awake, jay or gay, blossomed, fully blossomed. So that's the first part of bodhicitta. We can put these two ideas of fully bloomed and awakened together and basically say awake and fully bloomed. So we can if we follow the example of the Buddha, we can break from illusion and find timeless wisdom. When we wake up, we see illusion for what it is, and we progress towards awakening. And we have fewer and fewer moments of illusion. And then wisdom can come in its fullness. So we've sort of teased out the meaning of Buddha, Bodh in bodhicitta. Now let's look at the Sanskrit word for the Sanskrit word citta. What does that mean? It means heart or mind. So bodhicitta means the heart mind of the Buddha. This understanding of bodhicitta is the basis for everything I'm going to talk about today. If you understand that, you'll get the talk. First of all, let's ask ourselves if we're practicing bodhicitta. Are we asking ourselves whether we're practicing the heart-mind of the Buddha? Is that truly what we want? Do we aspire to become Buddhas? That's why we're here. It's not impossible. It's hard. But it's not impossible. So, according to a sutra, there are two categories, you might say, for bodhicitta: relative and ultimate bodhicitta. If you get nothing else out of this talk today, I hope you come to understand those two concepts: relative bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is bodhicitta as it is, the Buddha's heart. It's the Buddha's mind. It's the Buddha's mind is only the Buddha has it. Another way to look at it is that actually, ultimate bodhicitta is what our innermost nature is. We call it Buddha nature. That's us. That's in us. That's our innermost nature. It's what you really are in the awakened state. In Sanskrit, they say param gate, 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 param gate, param gate, soha, which means totally gone beyond. So that's ultimate bodhicitta. Now let's look at relative bodhicitta. In Tibet, they say it's khunsop when they refer to relative bodhicitta. And you know what that means? Totally fake. It's made up. It's constructed. Which sounds sort of harsh, doesn't it? I mean, to say something like that. But it means that right now we're asleep. We're deluded. And what it means is that through our Dharma practice, we're going from certain deluded concepts to less deluded concepts. That what we have in Dharma is made up, artificial, in relation to ultimate bodhicitta. It's artificial. It's made up. And it's fake, but only in relationship to what is ultimate. Does that make sense? Are you getting my point here? Okay. It's not to say that relative bodhicitta should not be honored or should be mistreated. No, it just means that it's not where we stop. We're going for Buddhahood, and we use various concepts in Dharma to help us get there. It's like they get us from A to B to C, on down, finally gets us ultimately to absolute bodhicitta, to Buddhahood. So Dharma, with all of its artifice of thoughts and feelings, is relative. Another way to look at the relative is, it is what you need at any given stage of your development. But at a higher stage, you can dispose of what you've learned at a lower stage. That's why we really need good teachers to help us to identify where we are and take those teachings that are necessary for us at the stage we are. Otherwise, we'll get confused. So all Dharma, all the time, is not relevant to you at any given time. As Kenpo Ken says, it is like this: not all Dharma is good for everybody all the time. Buddha taught so much and for so long that he taught at different people at different stages of their development, for them at different stages of development. Eventually, this relative, or the word I used before, fake, all falls away, and we get to the ultimate truth, which never changes, has never changed, and never will change. So until we get to the ultimate truth, we have a series of constructed dharmas. It's sometimes called expedient or convenient or practical for us right here, right now. So bodhicitta has two aspects, the ultimate and the relative. Ultimate is Buddha mind, and the relative is that journey that takes us to the Buddha mind. So I'm going to talk a little bit about historical perspective here, and I try not to talk about it too long. I don't want to bore you. But basically, the Buddha Bodhisattva teachings come to us in two sources. Of course, all of them go back to the Buddha, but basically there are two sources. What the Buddha taught, subsequent teachers have brought out the clarity of those teachings or the more clear intent of them. And two of those teachers are Nagarjuna and Asanga. So the Bodhisattva teachings come in those two streams. Nagarjuna lived in the second century of this common era, approximately. And he described bodhicitta as we've just explained it. We start out totally deluded, and through the relative, we are led to the ultimate. Nagarjuna compared ultimate bodhicitta to the final destination, where we go, and relative bodhicitta as the road to get there. this second stream we talk about from Asanga, his teachings, he described bodhicitta in terms of commitment. In a very real sense, Asanga found the key to our understanding of bodhicitta and the bodhisattva. According to Asanga, relative bodhicitta, we're breaking it down further, relative bodhicitta could be seen in two aspects. The first aspect is commitment to the result, the commitment to ultimate bodhicitta, to Buddha mind. And he called that aspirational. We long to be a Buddha. Some people discount aspiration as less important than practice, that we should practice. And that's the other part of Asanga's categorization: practice bodhicitta and aspirational bodhicitta. And some people say, well, aspiration, what's the big deal about that? We want to get to practice. It's sometimes a little hard to practice. I'll give you an example of what we're talking about when we're talking about aspiration, how important it can be before we get to actual practice. About 20 years ago, I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes every day. I knew that was going to cause me problems. It's horrible. But I couldn't stop. But every day, and I don't know how long this took me, but almost every day I said, today's the day. I aspire not to smoke. And every day I go buy a pack of cigarettes, smoke a couple out of them, and tear the pack up and throw it away. I got out of that habit, and then I started bumming off of people. But all during this period of time that I was still smoking and didn't want to, I had the aspiration. I don't want to do this behavior. I want to stop, but I did not yet have the commitment. But that aspiration eventually got me to the point that one day I quit. Haven't smoked one cigarette in 20 years. Now, to someone on the outside looking at me, say, well, all of a sudden he just quit like that. But that's not the way it was with me. It took a couple of years of aspiring to get to the point that I was committed to actually being a non-smoker. Okay, so let's come back to bodhicitta. I want to be a Buddha. I really want to help people. I want to do the right thing. And I say that in the morning. And by evening, I look and I see what I've done. Being a Buddha means regarding others as more important as yourself, or at least as important as yourself. And here I am making decisions every day that are basically for my self-interest. And sometimes in that doing that, I've actually hurt people. But, oh my, I really do want to be a Buddha. So this aspiration is really important. And next Saturday, Lama Kathy is giving this vow. And for some of us who will attend that, it will still be an aspiration. It will be not that I will actually practice being. I will try. I will get up every day and I'll say, today is the day I'm going to put other people ahead of my own welfare. Today's the day. And when I fail, I get up the next day and I make the same vow. I'll try again. So, to bring this all to a conclusion here, in terms of aspiration, it's absolutely necessary. It's absolutely necessary to the vow of a bodhisattva, of achieving bodhicitta. It's one of the aspects of bodhicitta. And that's where we start. But it's not enough, obviously. In my case, simply wanting doesn't get it. So the real practice of bodhicitta comes when we actually can make the full commitment of doing it. So we have to do what needs to be done to get there. Wishing won't do the job. Gampopa, in Ornament of Liberation, which is a book almost every beginner reads, and I strongly recommend it for everyone. Yeah, and you can go back to it, circle around back to it, no matter how long you practice. Anyway, in the book Ornament of Liberation, he said, if you thought you could just one day wake up and think you will be a Buddha, it won't happen. There's a path and a lot of work that goes along with reaching it. So we have to have a commitment to the path of liberation. And that's called practice bodhicitta. Dedication to what needs to be done. Then the wish actually becomes a reality. So a sangha, which is that second tradition, emphasizes aspiration and then practice. So there is the reality of Buddha mind, and there is also the striving for that goal. Striving to dissolve all of our delusions, which keep us from the stages of the path step by step. And at some point, a beautiful point to reach, at some point we don't vacillate. You know, when I was trying to quit, I made this commitment, I made this aspiration, and I would vacillate and go back. But at some point, beautiful point, I stopped vacillating. I'm going to do this. And there is a stage in our path where we no longer vacillate. I'm going to do this. I'm committed to this. Gampopa compared that kind of bodhicitta to gold. It's uncorrupted. It lasts. It's complete. So we can strive for that day where we don't vacillate. There's no question about it. When I get up today, my thoughts are for the welfare of all beings. And I will do that decisively in this life and all future lives. I'm going to strive for Buddhahood. And everything else I do or say will be insignificant to that greater goal. But the most important thing to remember here right now is that it is a process and it is gradual and it takes endurance, it takes perseverance. And it won't come overnight. So let's go back to ultimate bodhicitta. Let's circle around back to ultimate bodhicitta. We said that's the Buddha's mind. That's our nature, our innermost nature. And there's all kinds of beautiful teachings that you can read about. They're down in the library. There's Dzogchen and Mahamudra teachings, the highest teachings within our lineage. They're beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But if you try to read them without really starting from the beginning, they're just intellectual stuff. They won't mean too much to you. They're pretty, but they won't mean a lot to you. We have to begin at the beginning. And where does the beginning of, where is the beginning of bodhicitta? Love. That's how we reach the Buddha's heart and mind. First, it begins with love. The journey begins with love. And if we're on this path, love grows to fill every day, all day long. Isn't that worth striving for? To think that we could fill our days with love all day long? I mean, let's be honest here. Coming here this morning, how many less than lovely thoughts did you have? And how many will you have before the end of the day? That can cause you to be upset too, yeah. All kinds of thoughts can arise that are less than lovely. But to hold out this vision, this bodhisattva vision of our lives being full of love from the beginning of it, the day to the end, and even in our sleep. So, without love, we get lost in a lot of intellectual dharma, and there's a lot of that around. And that's a big obstacle to your actual growth. Remember, bodhicitta means the heart and the mind of the Buddha. If I were to say to you, "Who are you?" you would say, "I'm me." I doubt if you would say, "I'm me." You would say, "I'm me, it's your heart." The Buddha's path begins with love, not a lot of head stuff. We're not waking up to some sort of concept, but to the mind and heart of the Buddha. We're waking up our hearts. So we have to understand the importance not only of ultimate bodhicitta, but relative bodhicitta, even knowing that it's constructed and it's artificial. In the, you will see that frequently. We do deity practices. That involves creating a world within our mind, which, by the way, is probably more real than the actual delusion out here in everyday life, but it's still what we create in our minds. And we use that to gain a higher understanding of ultimate bodhicitta. So let's circle back again to ultimate bodhicitta. And again, as I said, there are all kinds of beautiful words about that. But it's really indescribable. Buddha mind, Buddhahood is indescribable. So why am I even talking about it? If it's indescribable, why would I even talk about it? What's the point of thinking about it? Well, we talk about it and we think about it to give ourselves a clue of what it might be like, knowing it's still words. Gompopo, who is our lineage master, he describes ultimate bodhicitta in this way. He says, it's vivid clarity that transcends the world. This vivid clarity transcends, goes beyond the eight consciousnesses. And it's without conceptual elaboration. It's without concept. It's without sets of words that are in our head. What does vivid clarity mean? It means unlimited. The opposite of clarity is blocked. Right now we're in four walls, right? And a window. But we're basically confined within four walls. Our view is obstructed. Ultimate bodhicitta, the walls fall. We see clearly what is. Not our delusion, but what is. That's Buddha mind. Ultimate bodhicitta, what is within us, has nothing limiting. It has no walls. Nothing that limits love, nothing that will limit wisdom, nothing that limits. It's clear, it's free, it's not about duality, that versus this. It's our Buddha nature. It's Buddha mind that is self-aware. It's unpolluted. And here's the point. No matter what has happened in our history, whatever good or bad, particularly bad that we've done, will not destroy that clarity. It is there in us. So don't worry. The worst thing you have ever done or ever will do will not destroy that Buddha nature, that ultimate bodhicitta that is within you. As Gompopa says, all the fires that have ever burnt cannot damage it. Our Buddha heart, with all of its love, peace, and its power, has never been damaged. Whatever those deeds are, they are like nightmares. They're like dreams. So the Buddha mind is unpolluted, it is unwavering, it does not have a moment of this or that, it is timeless. It's without a past or a future, and it's totally stable. There's a often quoted line that's an analogy to this Buddha mind, as it is an unwavering flame that burns in a summer's night. Our Buddha nature is like a flame, unwavering, that burns in a summer's night. It's luminous, and it illuminates everything around it. That's the image. That's the image of our Buddha nature. So the question we ask ourselves if we think we have reached Buddhahood is our minds clear? Are they unlimited? Are they unpolluted? Are they vacillating? Are they like a flame in the summer's night? I can answer that question for myself. No. But that's what we're striving for. Ultimate bodhicitta, it's impossible to say anything except to mouth words of our great masters. We're striving for it, and we can get clues to it, and we do practices that get us closer to it. And we meditate. And when you're ready, you do Mahamudra meditation. And we do that under a teacher's guide. So it's sort of like ultimate bodhicitta is the citadel, the fortress on the hill. And relative bodhicitta is the path we take to get there. We say this prayer often. Bodhicitta is precious. Those to whom it has not arisen, may it arise. Those in whom it has arisen, may it never deteriorate, but grow stronger and stronger. So relative bodhicitta, which is part of the vow we take when we take it, and again, I encourage you all to come next Saturday at 10 o'clock. Relative bodhicitta is about commitment. It's not saying that at this moment I've reached perfection. It means I want it. I want to go there. And we are working towards what is literally a sea change in our normal view. When I wake up in the morning, what am I thinking about? Me, mine, I, what am I going to do? Blah, 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 blah. All these fixations that I have and the misery that causes me and other people. With the bodhisattva vow, we want to take a 180-degree turn to start saying, oh, there are really people out here. So what causes this vow to arise? Or what is it that creates this desire to reach Buddhahood? Well, it comes from compassion. That's clearly the teaching of all of our teachers. It begins with compassion. There is so much suffering in this world. Does anyone doubt that? And if we're honest, there's so much suffering in our own lives. Think of your friends, your neighbors, your family. They all suffer. We could reflect on this for a long time. And the really sad thing about all of this suffering is most of it's needless. It doesn't have to be that way. So this suffering moves us to compassion. We become aware of people's suffering. So you might say it really begins with awareness. We become aware, we look around, we see it. We see the suffering. That moves us to compassion. And where does this compassion come from? It comes from love, the love for other people. I want you to be okay. I want you to feel safe. I want you to be happy. I love you. I want to do whatever I can to help you. Ah, here's the complication. You're complicated. I'm complicated. I can't help you right now in the way I would want. So it's much more complicated. So the first step is simply becoming aware of suffering. Then we develop compassion, and that comes from love. This awareness of suffering is really important in the Buddhist path. And it challenges our self-fixation. He's not here right now, but a friend of mine, Chris, he owns a restaurant down in Athens, and this crow with a broken wing wound up on his restaurants in the entrance of the restaurant. And he called me and he said, "Lama Tom, what do I do with this crow? It's got a broken wing and it's interfering with the traffic between people coming in to get, to come into the restaurant. What do I do? It's a distraction. What do I do?" And he was advised, to bring it in, to put it to sleep. And I said, "Well, I don't know what you do with it, but whatever you do, be mindful." And Chris is a very mindful person. He said, "Well, I can't kill it." And eventually, the customers sort of took this bird under their concern, and so they brought it out, French fries. And so it's like it's sticking around. And my point is, a lot of people wouldn't be as mindful of a creature like that. And that's a sign of growth, the fact that Chris looked and said, "This animal, this bird is suffering. What do I do? What can I do?" And he decided, there's nothing I can do. But in not doing anything, actually, other people helped. But oftentimes we don't know exactly what to do, right? Or we can do the obvious things. If you need food, I can offer food. If you need clothing, I can offer. If you need a hug, I'm here to help. But it's much more complicated than that. We're much more complicated than that. So I can give you food, I can give you clothing, I can give you all kinds of material things. But here's the rub, and you all know this. Even people with lots of resources are unhappy, right? Rich people are unhappy too. So what's the point here? The point is, ultimately, the only thing that is going to give us lasting happiness, true lasting happiness, is Dharma. And the only way I'm going to be able to give Dharma is by myself following the path of Dharma. And until I have really incorporated into my being Dharma, I'm only going to be somewhat superficially helpful to anybody. So that's the work we have. And the interesting thing about Dharma is being able to give it It becomes sustainable on the other person's part. I give you something, the tools you can use to liberate yourself. So it's through Dharma that we can sustain other people in their happiness, help them to do that. The interesting thing about bodhicitta is that as I am working to help myself, I can also help you. And it's also interesting to note that helping others doesn't diminish myself. I actually grow as a result of helping you. And the other part to it is that my growing does not diminish you. You will grow as a result of my being able to wisely and maturely help you. So there's no contradiction here between my working on myself and giving myself time to grow and to mature and my helping you. There's no contradiction. We can and should do both. But the only way we're ever going to help one another is to make the commitment. First of all, aspire for the Buddha mind, and then commit, fully commit to the Bodhisattva path, the path of, I will reach Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. And that's a big deal. The Bodhisattva vow is a big deal. And right now, perhaps the most we can do is, because we carry a lot of baggage, maybe the best thing we can do is aspire to it. And you can take the vow based upon your aspiration. And know that little by little, if you persist, you'll grow. I guarantee it. I guarantee you that if you take the vow with the aspiration to grow and then eventually make that commitment, you will develop the heart and the mind of the Buddha. So let's just take a minute to take this in. So relax, you don't have to get all uptight. Sometimes when you say meditate, people say, yeah, we have to. Just relax. Take some deep breaths. And our desire, our aspiration, is to develop that mind that's like the unwavering candle flame on a summer's night. So I, unfortunately, went longer than I thought, so we won't have time for questions. But let's take out, it's called Opening Prayer of Aspiration. We're actually going to close with this prayer. Prayer of Aspiration. And we'll say it in English. And we'll just say it once. Does everyone have it? Okay. May all sentient beings gain happiness and the cause of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May they never be cut off from the highest bliss, which is devoid of suffering. May they come to rest in the great impartiality, which is free of attachment and aversion. And finally, let's do the dedication prayer on the flip side. So, by this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. So my hope is that you take seriously the possibility you can develop the Buddha's mind and heart. My hope is that we all make that aspiration, willing to take the journey. And in the meantime, aspire. So my hope is maybe your homework for the next week. Make the aspiration that today I'm going to do my best to put the welfare of others at least as important as my own. Make the aspiration. Don't worry about whether you can accomplish it, but just note that. And then during the day, when something selfish comes up and you do something selfish, simply note that. Don't beat yourself up, just notice it. And sort of say to yourself, well, maybe the next time, maybe I can do better. Aspire to the Buddha's mind and heart. Thank you all for listening. May you have a great week. And hope to see you next Saturday at 10. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.